I hired a sub, older woman, black woman, traveled the world. She was retired. Her husband had money, so she was just coming to the school to help out. And I remember one day she came and she talked and she just spoke to me. She said, listen, she said, when I first came, I wasn't really feeling you. I didn't like your approach. But then I realized you're serious about educating black children. And she said, but here's what I want you to know. And I've traveled the world. She said, you really want to educate black children? She was like, find out how you could do it outside the schoolhouse. Right. She was like, find out, like, go get whatever money, whatever programs. And find out, she said, because you won't be able to do it in public education. Not the way it needs to be done. And that resonated with me.
You are now part of the social experiment.
See, now where my limit is, only God knows. It's like they just want to see you struggle. I swear they don't want to see you shine.
They don't.
It's like they just want you to bleed and they want you to fall. They don't want you to be where the streets are paved with gold.
Welcome to Mastermind, the home of Black excellence and self-mastery. Yes, your host, Mr. G.
Welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us today on the journey towards self-mastery. Our next guest is a former school principal turned therapist. He's also an author, a TEDx speaker, a human behavior specialist who focuses on a non-colonized therapeutic approach. He has a PhD in counseling with a specialization in metaphysical counseling. He runs a private practice called I Am International in Atlanta. He's author of the book, I Am the Solution. He's often referred to as the male version of Ayanla Van Zandt. Let's welcome today, Dr. Curtis D. Jasper to the program.
Appreciate it, man. Thank you so much. What's going on, Mr. G? Thank you for having me.
Pleasure's mine, man. Pleasure's mine, man. We had a quick convo before the program and I was saying, like, I ran across your work through YouTube. And it's interesting because not a lot of males talk about, specifically black males, talk about, our experiences in the way that you do. And I know not only do you talk about it, but you've studied it. And I have a great appreciation, you know, for the work that you're doing, because not enough gets out about some of our struggles, the things that we go through. And then the data on, you know, just talking to a large number of black men and black boys so we can find those connections and what we dealing with, man. So I appreciate your work, man.
Absolutely. Thank you, man. Appreciate that.
Yes, sir. So just for everybody listening in, kind of want to get to know you a little better before we get into the work that you do, man. So I know you were born and raised in South Side of Chicago, 70s and 80s. So
yeah,
walk us through that, man. Walk
I know,
us through
right? That. It wasn't easy. I made it through though, but it wasn't easy.
Yes, sir. So what was your childhood like, man, growing up?
I actually thought, now that I'm older and, you know, my parents are deceased, I actually thought it was worse than what it really was, right? I now get for myself that I had a pretty good childhood, right? Basic stuff, raised primarily by my mom. My father was active in my life. I am the youngest of three. I have an older brother and an older sister. Growing up on the South Side was fun. I did well in school. I did well in athletics. Socially, I did well. Things were amazing. Right. I went to a top school outside of the hood I grew up in. So I had exposure to high expectations when it came to education. I was able to take foreign languages and, you know, just take advantage of some things that weren't allowed in my neighborhood school. Then I went, I went to high school, did well in high school, went away to college, came back home, graduate school, started off in public education as a classroom teacher. And then, got into some educational consulting and training and then became an administrator. Then I left education, jumped into the real estate heavily when the market was really doing well. And then this would be my second career. You know, went back to school. I had started a couple doctoral programs in the past. And so I kind of just jumped back in it. And as a result of going through some tough times myself, I used not only my own healing journey of working with therapists, but also studying, you know, psychology in the mental health field so that I could see how I can contribute as I was healing. So my ultimate goal, what really allowed me to heal, is that I had an outlook on first healing myself, which there's no arrival, but the ongoing journey of healing, and then reaching back and supporting brothers who look like me.
Powerful work, man. Powerful work. Your healing started, though, when you was a teenager. You went into therapy as a teen, like what was going on at that point in your life and what was that experience, that therapeutical experience?
Right. Typical teenage boy stuff, acting out, getting into fights. I did well in school, so the world didn't come down on me that hard, right? That's the catalyst, mm-hmm. right? A lot of young males, they kind of mess up and then they don't do well in school. Well, I held it down in school, but I kind of got into some social challenges, fighting, being disrespectful at the house, really just not owning my own pain at the time. And so my mom, she worked at a local university, and part of her benefits was she had access to all service providers. So it started out, here's the funny thing. It actually started out as me going to therapy, but it ended up being family therapy, right? So I went to the first session, and once the therapist kind of heard my story, she pulled my mom in, and then my brother, then my sister, then my dad, who didn't even live in the house. So it became a family therapy, and we learned some vital tools. So one of the things that I know, and I practice this now, Mr. G, is that when a particular person goes into therapy, it's really a family thing. It's sort of like when someone passes away or go to jail or get sick. We all have to make adjustments. We're so in therapy as well. I get calls every day, and people are like, oh, my husband, my son. I'm like, they are the ones who are exhibiting the most symptoms that has gotten other agencies involved. But they're not in isolation doing these things. It's right. in relationship to the relationships in the house. That's where it starts. And so I'm glad I had that experience, right? I didn't walk into therapy like, oh, ain't nothing wrong with me. I ain't talking to somebody. I walked into therapy like, everybody about to get exposed in this joint.
Oh, man. All right. So do you think it was like your father not being present, like in the home? Was that a
Absolutely.
Big thing?
Absolutely. You get through your pubescent stage, you go through adolescence, then you start to defy authority. Oftentimes when young black males don't have the original authority, which is the father figure in the home, they start to resent and despise all forms of authority. Mm. And that includes some of their peers. Like, nobody checks me. Nobody tells me what to do. I'm self-sufficient, and it becomes problematic. But that's where it stemmed from, not having that safety of that male father guidance. Right? I had it indirectly, but he didn't live in a house with.
So you're talking about indirectly, you mean like your teacher or your father?
Yeah, like my dad was around, right? But he didn't live in a house with me.
Gotcha. Right?
So my dad, you know, he was active, or I now realize he was active. But there was a couple of things that made his presence seem more impactful than it did. So I went to schooling outside the neighborhood. Now, in my hood, it was pretty customary that dads weren't around. But I actually went to school where dads were around, right? Mm. So I went to school in the upper middle class area, and dads were more active for various reasons. So my dad lived in the area that I went to school in. My dad was considered upper middle class. We weren't staying with mom, but he was. And I resented that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Another component of like the work that you do, you talk about the absence of fathers. And I felt like, you know, another key component that you mentioned is even some fathers that are in the house are still absent, and it still has an impact. So what do you think is the impact on just black children when the fathers are absent, whether they're physically absent or emotionally absent?
Well, fathers provide that validation, period. Girls, boys, we provide the icing on top. I heard this one brother mention that mothers create memories and fathers help create belief. Right. Mm-hmm. Or something to that effect. So fathers actually provide the validation. Mom has that nurturing, but, you know, we kind of outgrow that. But without having that validation on a day to day or at least a regular basis, we tend to seek that in other areas. Right. We struggle with our self-identity. What does it mean to be masculine? Right. Because we're primarily submerged with mom. Right. And mom is mom. So we know we're missing some critical things in our development. So without dads regular. Now, let me make this clear, and I share this with you. It's not all on dad. No one man can do it all. I tell people all the time, you got the best dad in the world. You still need coaches and teachers and pastors and uncles and OGs and big brothers. And, you know, one man doesn't possess everything any of us need.
Right.
But it is a great foundation to build upon.
That makes sense. All right. So you your first career was being an educator, which eventually led into being a principal. Why did you want to be an educator? Like, what was your experience when you got there, Chicago Public Schools? And then what led you out of there?
Really? Good question. Great question. So I actually had a great educational experience, right? And I wanted to give that to Black boys, right? Now, mind you, I was bused to the school, but I had a great educational experience, right? I just did. And it's a large amount outside of my parents and my support system of where I am today. And I was on the receiving end. So I knew what it meant to receive quality education. And I made it my business to be on the other end to provide that for Black children, focusing on Black boys. I left that public education. It's because I knew once I became an administrator and had the big office and the big chair, that public school was not designed to support the development of Black boys. And so I could not continue to take the money from Black taxpayers' dollars and be a part of a system inundated with bureaucracy and systemic racism that was not in alignment with the full development of Black boys. And I left.
Mm. Now, was it specific things that you were seeing, like at the school that you were at?
Absolutely. But I had been to several schools. I was a consultant, nationally referenced consultant. So I was able to travel around and train teachers in various. I've been to Philadelphia Public Schools, L.A., Tulsa, Birmingham, Chicago, Detroit, you name it. I've been to the major ones. So I was able to step outside of Chicago Public Schools. I came to Atlanta. I was actually an administrator in Atlanta at the Fulton County Schools. So I had my hand on the pulse of urban education, and I knew that it wasn't sufficient. Now, my particular experience, I remember this one time, I hired a statistician to come in and sort of disaggregate my test scores so that I could see where to put my money in terms of instructional program. And I realized that my boys weren't doing as well as my girls. So I wanted to pull my boys for certain subjects into all gender, you know, to all gender specific classes. Right. And the school board would not let me do that. And I was like, here's the test scores. I don't need them the whole day. I get Title IX and all the bureaucracy, but I need to pull boys in this grade for these specific subjects at this time. And they refused. And I was like, oh, I get it. Y'all ain't interested in educating Black boys. Because that ain't the money. You got to follow the money. Right? So the money is not in regular ed. The money is either in special ed or gifted and talented.
Yeah. Yep. And we definitely ain't in the gifted talented like
correct.
We should be.
Correct. But most people don't realize that is a form of special ed as well.
Hmm. Yeah, absolutely. The gifted and talented programs are
right,
special.
Right.
Right. Right about that. All right. So was it that, like, that specific experience that was like, yo, it's time to go? Or did you have like something traumatic occur where you're like, yo, now I'm done? Or
yeah, it was a series of things. I mean, I came in really serious. So I had my eyes open and I had mentors. I remember one of my mentors, she wasn't a mentor. One of my mentors was like, you'll go far in education. I hired a sub, older woman, Black woman, traveled the world. She was retired. Her husband had money. So she was just coming to the school to help out. And I remember one day she came and she talked and she just spoke to me. She said, listen, she said, when I first came, I wasn't really feeling you. I didn't like your approach. But then I realized you're serious about educating Black children. And she said, but here's what I want you to know. And I've traveled the world. She said, you really want to educate Black children? She was like, find out how you could do it outside the schoolhouse. Right. She was like, find out, like, go get whatever money, whatever programs and find out. She said, because you won't be able to do it in public education, not the way it needs to be done. And that resonated with me.
Got it. All right. So fast forwarding a bit in your TED talk, you mentioned that you were heavy into the real estate game and you went through some things in 2008 that kind of led to other things. So can you talk about that with us and how you were able to get through that difficult time?
Yeah. So around 2004, 2005, real estate was hot in Atlanta. I did really well, right? Made some money, got the big house, the fancy cars, right? The Jaspers were doing well. And somewhere around 2009, when the market, 2008, 2009, when the market started crashing, my mother became ill with cancer. And she eventually transitioned. And then my marriage kind of fell apart. So financially, the bottom fell out. My marriage fell out. I was grieving my mom, and a few years later, my dad. I hadn't recovered from any of that. I just didn't know. I went through a series of 5 therapists, as I mentioned in the TED Talk, and I sort of crashed out for about 5 years. So I'll say anywhere from 2009 to 2014, late 2013, I kind of laid down on the job, right, and lost it all. I let it crumble. And, you know, when I was ready and started feeling better and did some work, I slowly came out of it.
Got you. So you just mentioned you went to see 5 therapists. 4 of them were Black. And I hear, you know, all the time we talk about we need more Black therapists, which you mentioned that Black mental health providers are about 4% of the population and we need more. For your own personal experience, the Black therapist really didn't do much for you. So what was not connecting with the Black therapist that when you reached the 5th therapist, which was a white therapist, that you were able to get a connection?
Right, right. Exactly. So, which is in my bio, I use the term this sort of like this uncolonized or this decolonized approach to mental health. So the Black therapist, not to throw Black solidarity to all day long, but not to throw who are now my colleagues now under the bus. But at the time, their emphasis, in my opinion, was more on the industry itself than really speaking to where I was. Right. They went right into the clinical aspect, the assessments, you know, the training. And I didn't know if it was their experience or if that's just part of the training. But I know it didn't work for me. I kept going. And so the 5th provider, again, I wasn't focusing on whether they were white or Black. I actually had made a commitment to a close friend of mine that I would go see one more therapist. And he happened to be a white male. Right. And that was the catalyst. That was the changing when he sort of spoke to me. He didn't tell me about anything in the mental health industry. He didn't clinicalize me. He didn't assess me. He didn't diagnose me. He just spoke to me after he listened to me. Mm-hmm. And it was that training point. And I use that as the basis of mine, right? Like just be with the people. Be with the people, not the industry, the people.
Got it. Now, you mentioned a colonized approach to therapy. What exactly does that mean for those that are not?
So mine would be uncolonized or decolonized. That means I'm moving away from the Western standard mental health approach, right? For Black people specifically, we have a unique experience being Black, obviously, in this country, but there's a different approach. There's not much research out there that I've come across that really supports our uniqueness. And what I find to be destructive a lot of time is misdiagnosis because we're following a Western standardized approach to mental health. Now, mental health is part of the medical industrial complex, right? So that comes with a host of other things, right? And so what I find is we have to be unique in our approach to serving Black people in particular. There's a cultural competence that other people may be required, but there's a cultural lived experiences that we as Black people know, right? Mm-hmm. We know. You may come to me and be like, yeah, I'm feeling depressed. And after sharing, it could be the pressure from systemic racism at your job. Things of that nature, right? So I'm not going to say like, hey, let's go through this assessment. I'm like, bruh, tell me more, right? So those things. So I take away the white approach to practicing mental health. And I use a combination of spirituality, coaching, counseling, mental health, psychology, education, metaphysics, right? Black psychology, African spirituality, right? Christianity, right? There's an approach that I use outside of leaning on the clinical training of being a psychologist or a mental health practitioner.
Got it. All right. So that therapist influenced you to kind of become a therapist yourself. And through that whole process and that journey, you know, while you were going through your stuff, in your TED Talk too, you mentioned that you spent 60 days in prison for, was it child support or?
Right. So I had missed a court date. It was around child support, but I had missed the court date. And for whatever reason, there was a bench warrant assigned to that court date. And I happened to be at the emergency room during the time. And although the judge received a signed excuse from a medical doctor, for whatever reason, he didn't believe that. So to settle that warrant, I obviously had to go through some stuff. And the bureaucracy around it, I ended up staying in jail for 57 days. And there was a component where I had to pay back child support, and there was some probation around. It was a mess. All of that stemmed from an eventful divorce several years earlier, right? Mm-hmm. And so I work with brothers like, just because the judge signs off on the divorce, stuff's just about to get started, right?
Man, I've heard so it. I've heard
it was some collateral damage as a result of a very complex divorce. And so, and I actually went to jail 2 days after I returned from Chicago my father had passed. And looking back now, it was probably the best rest I've ever gotten in my life. 57 days, I was able to grieve my dad. I mean, obviously, I had to be in the cell with a celly and wear the jumpsuit for 57 days, but I was able to rest and sort of get off the grid. It wasn't easy, but it wasn't necessary.
That's interesting. So I guess that inspired you to write your book, You Are the Solution, right? So it's S-O-U-L, Solution. So people might be like, all right, you're saying that people are the solution themselves. So why would I go and see a Dr. Jasper? You know what I'm saying? If I'm the solution myself.
Correct. Correct. Because sometimes we need fresh eyes, a fresh voice, and some fresh ears on our situation. What I know from my lived experiences is there are other people in the form of blessings who speak specifically to us, right? For me, it was the same teacher I had for 5 years in a row, and my mother, and other people have come into my life. So my job as an educator is to remind you that the power is within. And we can talk all the stuff we want, right? I'm not here to motivate you or dissect you. I'm here to remind you of your greatness. I'm here to remind you that everything you need is within, right? Mm. And I'm here to walk this journey alongside of you. But first and foremost, I'm not the magician. I'm not the superhero. You are. And I can tell you that because I've been through a lot of what the average brother who comes to me has been through. Mm-hmm. All of them.
Got it. In your book, you also talk about that you had to change your mind state, you know what I mean, to realize that you were the solution. And some people might view that as like you blame yourself for your circumstances or what happened. But was it you blaming yourself, or was it you putting the responsibility on yourself in regards to how?
It was me owning myself. It was me taking back my power. I wasn't blaming myself, but what I wasn't blaming other people. I stopped blaming my father, my ex-wife, the judicial system, right? I had a long laundry list of who to blame. So what I realized is that anger, that resentment, that rage around blaming folks caused me some very challenging things. Mm-hmm. And so me taking the only thing that I had left was to go within. I did what they said outside, right? I went to school. I stayed out of jail coming up. Like, I did all the right thing. I realized that this was something I had to do from the inside out. So I wasn't blaming myself. I owned 100% of the things that happened to me. And it's like real estate. You only can sell, release, sublease, Airbnb out something that you own first. So I had to own it. Once I owned it, then I was able to really, really support myself. But that was just my way of taking my power back, man. It wasn't easy.
That makes sense. Part of that, you mentioned in your book too, that one of the things that you do mental health wise is to try to something new every day, or try it as much as possible. So what impact did that really have for you? And what do you think is the importance of us not staying with the same kind of routine, you know, regularly and things like that?
It's confidence. It's really, really, really stretching yourself. And find it. It's the self-discovery that actually aids in the healing journey. So trying things, new things, right? You got to try things. You have to fail your way to success, right? And part of that is most people are afraid to try things because they are overly consumed with not just failure, but what others are going to think. And so I try things knowing that the discipline builds the confidence, and the confidence sustains the discipline. So you start off small, whether it's writing a page in your journal, or doing some breathing exercises, or meditating, or making your bed, or doing 5 push-ups. It's really, Mr. G, about making promises to yourself and keeping them. Mm-hmm. Most of us have been let down with people who have made promises to ourselves, mm-hmm. our wives with vows, our parents, people, right? We are heartbroken from promises being broken. The last person that we need to blame is ourselves. trying new things is our way of making promises and making good on those promises. It's the healing of the heart.
That makes sense. Speaking of healing, one of the tough things I know going through a divorce and all that is learning, and you mentioned in your book too, to forgive your ex-wife and to forgive yourself, man. So how did you learn to forgive those, you know, two important people in your life?
It wasn't easy, man. Forgiveness is an ongoing process. You got to let that thing go sometimes. Sometimes, often. It ain't one thing you wake up like, I forgive you. As heavy as it is, depending on how heavy the burden is, will be how many times you got to release it. So you got, the willingness is there. So there's a forgiveness and there's a release. But you can't really hold the pain and the anger around and say, I forgive you from a lip service standpoint, Mr. G. You really got to release them. Like, I forgive myself. One of the things that I know is you can't forgive others unless you first forgive yourself. So I had to forgive myself for my role in the relationship. To forgive myself for choosing her. Not that it was a bad choice. I'm grateful for it. But I had to forgive myself. When I was able to forgive myself is when I was able to extend forgiveness to her. But she wasn't the only one. I had to forgive my father. I had to forgive a few people. She was just at the top of the list, but she wasn't the whole list.
That makes sense, man. I think that a lot of us can learn to forgive, man, because we hold on to a lot of anger and resentment, especially like with relationships when things don't work out, or you're on the outside, you know, with the kids and all that, and you're not getting those experiences. And some people tend to resent their partners, man, because of that. So that's powerful, man. So the next part of your journey was transitioning into being a mental health professional. And for your dissertation, you did a study on the emotional intelligence of Black males. I think emotional intelligence is something that we don't talk about enough of, especially in the Black community. So what did you kind of learn through your dissertation, covering and learning about examining Black males, boys and men that you kind of take with you and you teach?
Right. So first and foremost, I realized that starting with myself that the majority of us are emotionally illiterate. Right. We lack the intelligence because we lack the awareness and the literacy and the intelligence, and we lack how to support ourselves. So emotional intelligence in and of itself is our ability to experience emotions, right? To regulate our emotions with and still support ourselves and our well-being. What I find is, A, we just hadn't been taught that. And B, even though we are open to learning it now, there's a unique approach that we must do for Black males in particular. Right. And that's where the decolonized approach come in. So it was twofold. When I went through my tough times, I couldn't smart my way, thug my way, finesse my way. I couldn't do anything. I really had to surrender. But one thing I was missing is I'm not clear about this feeling. I know I'm pissed. I know I'm angry. I know I'm rageful, but it never occurred to me that I'm sad, that I'm disappointed, that I'm mad as hell. Right. That I'm heartbroken and there's guilt and shame. No one ever spoke to me on that level. Right. So I didn't even have that aha moment when I heard it. Like, and so I had to learn that. Right. And then when I learned it, I had to realize that there's an approach that I have to do that for Black men. Right. You can't just come up to a brother like, so you said, tell me what happened in second grade and blah. Nah, I got to come like this, like, bruh. What's good? What happened? Right. And then as they talk and then they describe their story, Mr. G, then they'll say, yeah. And then I was angry. And then I'll slip in. Were you angry or were you disappointed? They was like, I was disappointed. And I was like, yeah, because disappointed means unmet expectations. And because we don't like feeling bad, our default is angry. We don't like feeling bad. So we mad because we feeling bad.
Right. All right. That makes a ton of sense. Now, for those that are like acknowledging this and being like, yo, my emotional intelligence isn't that good. Like, how do you go about improving it and being emotionally literate, like you just mentioned?
Right. So the first step is awareness, right? Just becoming aware of how you're feeling in any given moment. There's a check in. Like, how you feeling, bro? Like, I do it now for a regular. How you feeling? You good? Sad? Happy? I'm all right. Because oftentimes it's not an emotional thing. It could be a physical thing, right? That causes it. Some brothers ain't ate all day. Some brothers dehydrated. Some brothers need to move their bowels. It is a struggle order, right? So the check-in is, how you doing? Moment to moment. day to day. So once you get that awareness, right? And then there's the literacy. Like, let me assign language to my feeling. Angry is different than mad. Angry means there's some unjust or unfairness, right? Whether it's George Floyd or the guy that just got killed by the five black officers. Like, I'm angry about that. But mad is a feeling of being personally violated. I may be angry because something that's happening in the community, but I'm mad as hell if you stole my identity and ran up my credit cards. That's different. I'm mad as hell. You personally violated me, right? It feels different in the body. So when you talk to a brother like that, you're like, all right, I got it. And then when you say sad, that's the experience as a result of loss, right? And when you tell a brother, hey, as black men, we are grieving more living things than things that have passed on. Like, we're grieving the relationship we lost in high school and college. We're grieving when the young lady we was dating had that abortion. We're grieving when we lost our job. We're grieving, like, we're grieving things a lot, right? You know, just talking with brothers builds that literacy. They can assign words to how they feel. And they ain't got to be experts on it. And then the third part is the intelligence sort of accrues, right, like we learn anything else. And then the fourth part, Mr. G, is the fitness. It's like hooping or whatever we do. We know we got to show up and we got to practice our game. There's no difference with emotions. So we have to be emotionally fit because we know life ain't getting easier, but we can be better at supporting ourselves.
That is interesting. For you personally, when you went to that fifth therapist, you thought you were depressed. And I feel like a lot of us, you know, confuse depression with sadness and other things. So for those that, you know, are struggling with their mental health, how do they understand the difference between actually being depressed and being sad?
Right. So there's a lot of talk around that, right? And there's a difference between the culture, right? So you could be classified as clinically depressed when you are at a point where you're sort of feeling bad and there's a duration, right? There's a length. You're not able to do your daily responsibilities, right? It's sort of a prolonged thing. But there's bouts of sadness that we come just from being black, living in this experience at this time, right? It can be classified based on which assessment you use. But one of the things that I offer is just talking it through with people and allowing them to assign it to what really sticks for them. So I don't go around saying, nah, you ain't depressed, you're sad. I do say, like, what is it for you? Like, is it like, have you been in the bed for weeks and ain't showered, ain't ate, ain't went to work? Or are you just resting because your nervous system is overloaded and you're emotionally exhausted? And so for me, right, I lost everything, but I still went to the gym because that was my way of pushing through. Could I have been a functionally depressive? Yes. But I also realized that I was sad, right? I didn't have, there were times where I thought about ending it all. The complexities that come with feeling bad for a certain amount of time. But I find that talking it through as a black man with other black men and allowing them to be like, yeah, that's it. Or no, that's it. That ain't it. Right. And allowing them to, as opposed to saying, here's what I think you are. It seems that you're clinically depressed and you need to take this. Nah, bro, we ain't doing none of that.
Interesting. Now, part of what you're talking about, too, is a support network, too, man. And I feel like there's not enough support for black males specifically. And a lot of the outside does not understand the black male, whether they're in the boy phase, the teen phase, or the man phase. So I just wanted to go through that real quick. Like, for people on the outside, the black mothers, the black siblings, the people in the community, how can they support these different groups of black males? When we're looking at black boys, how can they be a support for black boys in regards to their mental health? And then teens and men.
Outside of wonderful platforms like you have now, just really highlighting people who are doing the work and who have been through it. That's one way. But when it comes to rearing young black males, it's so complex that we need a bunch of moving parts, right? And so it could be a present dad or not. There's some developmental, spiritual, educational, physical, emotional things that are required, right? That are required. Young black brothers, a unique experience in rearing young black boys, particularly now. And we got the stronghold of social media, right? But a lot of our young boys have been sexually violated. So what turns out when they're teenagers and they're stealing cars and grabbing that pistol and robbing folks, they are trying to offset the struggle of their own self-identity because of some previously lived experiences that they have never shared with anybody, you know? And so I get a lot of that, right? And so we need to make sure that young Black boys are in contact with some form of mental health support like anything else. They're not broken to the point where we got to call when they need to go, just like the dentist, going to get a physical. It needs to be something that's maintenance, not preventative, not intervention, right? Just maintenance things. So those are some of the things. But then there's, you know, there's first aiders, there's brothers like you who are just having platforms spreading the word. There's books, there's barbershop, there's conversations, there's mentoring. Mentoring is key. Mentoring is key. So it's going to take all of us doing a lot of things for a very long time because, you know, each brother is different, right? You can meet him on a basketball court. You may meet him at a rap battle, at a cypher. You may have to go to school. Go where they are. You want to reach Black boys? Go where they are. Don't have them come to you. Go where they are. And if you're not willing to go where they are, then this ain't for you.
Facts. All right. So let's say I noticed that my Black boy needs a Dr. Jasper, but, you know, the less than 4%. How do I go about finding somebody mental health wise that's going to be right for them?
Right. Oftentimes it takes a while. It's sort of like finding a new barber or a dry cleaner. Sometimes you got to test drive a few things. But the power of social media and online is we have access. And a lady called me today, for example, wanted me to work with her husband. She was like, what's the best approach? I get this every week. What's the best approach to bring my Black male to you, whether he's my son, my brother, and that? And I said, introduce me to him online. Don't like, oh, yeah, you need to go talk to Dr. Jasper. I heard, You can be like, look, there's a dude online. Check him out. Let me know what you think. Gradually do that, right? See if they resonate me. I'm a regular dude, right? You see me like I wear t-shirts, jeans, and Jordan 1s, right? I'm not here to talk over their head. So one of the ways to do that is to boast people like me, because there's a few brothers out there that I could recommend, is to really allow these young people on their phones anyway, right? We could really be like, you seen dude? And, you know, and just say, let me know what you're thinking. Gradually introduce that to young Black boys. You'd be surprised on who young Black boys gravitate towards. I had tons of them. They rappers. They could be famous rappers. They could be professional athletes. You'd be surprised who reaches out to me. And some of them been following me for 8, 9, 7 months. They won't say nothing for a while until one day they like, let me hit dude up, right? And I just want them to know that I exist. When they ready, I'm here.
Got it. Now, I think personally, like, and I see this with a lot of Black males, boys, teens, men. One of the things that, and I know you mentioned before, that we struggle with is managing our anger, right? And we do a lot of regrettable things in each category with our anger. So what advice do you have for Black boys and Black men that struggle with their anger? I've heard, you know, men just like, yo, I got anger issues. Like, they just accept it. Like, they don't even try to fix it. They don't try to resolve it. This is my reality. So what advice do you have for those men that really struggle with their anger?
So two things to show up as I listen to your question. The first thing is, try to be clear on what it means to manage emotion. There is no managing emotions. The only part we need to manage is our reactions to the emotions, right? And when we get that over to the middle, like, it's okay for you to be angry. It ain't okay for you to act out angrily and be destructive, right? It's okay for you to sit and be like, I'm pissed like this. And you know what I mean? Like, get it out. Like, that part's okay. We made it taboo that Black men can't even feel bad, right? There's no managing the energy. We don't know how emotions work. So the first thing is, there is no managing emotions in and of itself. Emotions come and they go. The only part that we can manage is the difference between our reaction versus our response. And that takes some techniques and some tools and support. The other part is to teach young Black males how emotions work. We're not even sure how it works. Right. We don't know the connection between thoughts, feelings, and emotions and how that acts out in the behavior. So talking with a young Black male or older one and speaking to his level or something he can grasp using his lived experience as an example, allow him to be like, oh, that makes sense. Let me try it. Let me try it. So there's some cultural things that get in the way. We overly express when we're angry. We think there's something to do to alleviate the anger when the anger is in the body. The emotions are in the mind, right? Mm-hmm. They're in the body. They express, they are propelled through the thoughts. They're in the body. And so if we could teach young Black boys how to support themselves physically, right? There's some things to do when you get angry. It may not be punching his wall, right? It may not be texting your girl all crazy, right? It may be jotting down and doing some push-ups. I know it sounds crazy. It may be sitting back and doing some breathing exercises. Mm. It may be going to get a drink of water. I just need you to practice the pause. If you can practice the pause and start breathing, you can prove to your body and your mind, you don't have to stop being angry. You have to manage the behavior that the anger sort of propels you to do.
That makes a ton of sense, man. Another part of this is like the outside support where Black boys, Black men are, you know, expressing their emotions. And then you got mothers, parents that are like, well, I don't want to raise my kid to be soft and crying all the time or doing this and that. They got to be tough. And you got maybe partners saying like, well, how are they going to be my protector? And they sobbing over here doing this and that and the third, and they got issues. So how should the people on the outside helping Black men, the family, the wives, the girlfriends, their partners be thinking about, you know, their mental health and providing support, even in times where they might look weak?
Right. So looking weak is relative, right? There's a mm-hmm. lot of things. Crying, there's stress hormones that's released in crying, there's cleansing, and there's energy that's kind of released in that. We take on, again, my decolonized, uncolonized approach. We take on more capitalism, racism, patriarchy in terms of how they need to be superheroes. Says who?
Hmm.
Says who? This ain't even our stuff. Says who? He's not weak because he cried. He's not. There's superpowers in being sensitive, right? There's superpowers. So I think we need to reshape how we even view each other, particularly Black males. Right? Don't have to be super hard, right? Who made this up? Oftentimes, capitalism and systemic racism has caused us to put up things that are not even necessary or working in our favor, right? So you thinking he has to protect and provide because he never cried and he out there doing blue collar hard labor? That ain't it. That ain't it. So making it safe spaces, teaching the community that there's levels to what it means to be strong, right? There's healing and there's woundedness. Neither of them are predicated on strength or weakness. Most of it has to do with the support and the tools on the journey to recovery. A brother could cry. He ain't weak. That's his way. That's his way, right? So things of that nature, just educating us on what it means to be a cumulative, holistic male. Like we think a male, like if he cried, this is a Black male. If he cried, that's this part. I need you to love this part, although this part may make you uncomfortable. Mm. He's a cumulative, comprehensive male. You have limited to him to being this brute, bravado, overly hyper masculine. This is us.
We loving fragments
of Black males. Some of them are sons and you know, people in our family.
Now, you combine your therapeutic approach to spirituality and metaphysics, and some people might be like, well, that's way out there. Like, so for those that just don't understand that component, can you really dissect that for us?
Correct. So I have a license to say that whatever comes up in your session, we're going to go there. That's basically what it means. If you say we're talking about God, Buddha, Mother Teresa, the devil, Farrakhan, that's where we're going. I'm going to meet you where you are. I have the skill set, the knowledge and expertise to allow whatever healing modality that the person kind of latches onto, that's where we're going to go. I'm not here to fit you into what I think is best. I'm here to help co-create this new curriculum for living with you. All of us have a belief in something. So if half your session, you want to talk about your belief in God or growing up in the church, that's what we're talking about, right? And the other part is working with couples. You know, I have the ability to, after counseling couples, I have the ability to marry them. So there's a lot of benefits in my approach to serving people. I'm here to serve the people, right, as a result of that. So I combined my educational approach. I'm going to teach you how to heal yourself with the hopes of you sharing it with your loved ones. If I could assist you in healing you, then I know you can heal your family. You heal your family, then I know the family can heal the community. We heal the community, we can heal the larger community. And that's my goal.
Mm. Now, you know, we had the experience of the pandemic where you were doing a lot of virtual counseling and things like that. What have you noticed within Black men and males within the pandemic experience, you know, connecting what they're going through right now and their mental health? Because I feel like a lot of times when we talk about the pandemic, we're talking about the women, the mothers and what they experience, but not really, you know, the men. So what have you noticed with the men?
It's funny. I actually got more indications of disruptions with the mother and the children, the women and the children. The brothers wasn't, they didn't come out until later, towards the tail end.
Mm.
Ironically, it's almost, and I want to be careful how I said it, it's almost like the brothers were resting. It's almost like the world slowed down where the brothers were resting. I mean, they wasn't worried about necessarily providing because wasn't nothing moving at that time, but they were resting. And I'm not sure that lots of Black men have had that amount of rest, being at home, just chilling. The rest that was given to the Black man has served them well. Now, when they came out of the pandemic, like what I'm supposed to do, that's when the help. But the women and the children, the women, work stop, parenting, homeschooling, I got more calls from men. I primarily service men. But during the pandemic, I worked with a lot of women. The brothers was like, look, we're going to collect unemployment. We're going to go to the food bank. We're going to wear our mask and we're going to play these video games and chill. We gonna rest. We good. Like, ain't nothing moving. It wasn't like the women were out earning the men at the time. All of us was chilling. And right. The men was like, I'm chilling. It sounds crazy, but that's my experience. The brothers were like, I'm chilling. Gotcha. And when it was time to get back out in the real world, then it was like, oh, now I'm feeling the struggle. And that's when I started doing intense work with brothers.
That's interesting. Speaking of your work, can you talk about I Am International? Like, what is the work that you're doing with your organization and, you know, some of the work that and things that you're doing right now?
Right. So I do a lot of consulting and lecturing for corporate and learning institutions. Almost on a weekly basis, I may be doing a keynote for a major 500, you know, Fortune 500 corporation, talking to particularly Black and brown employees on how to support themselves from a mental and emotional standpoint and how corporate could do a better job of supporting. So the I Am is me. That's my teaching part, right? So the my primary focus is teaching people on how to support themselves, not identifying their symptoms and then, you know, diagnosing them. That's not my style. That's not even what I do. Teaching people, right, so that they could go ahead and heal themselves. How do you sustain your mental health outside of working with me? So the I Am International is a separate company that allows me to do broader things like corporate lecturing, keynotes, and consulting work for learning and other organizations.
All right. Before we wrap up, I want to get into a quick little activity here called What's Your Favorite? Identifying a few of your favorite things. You could elaborate or keep it short and simple. So I don't know if you still go through therapy sessions yourself right now, but what's been your favorite therapy session that you've ever had?
I do go to therapy from time to time, but one of my best therapy sessions are the ones where I get to laugh.
Gotcha.
Where, you know, there's a part at the beginning and then there's a part at the end where we could just chop it up. You know, those are the fun ones. I actually stole that approach too. So my favorite therapy sessions is like when we logged on, like, what's going on? What's good? Had a family. Little chuckle, then we get into business, and then we end with that. It's that unique bonding approach that really, really just warms my heart on both sides. When I'm a client and a patient, as well as serving other individuals.
Got you. And what is your favorite thing to do for your own mental health outside of therapy?
Work out and read. I journal, meditate, work out and read, man. I'm in the gym every day at 7 in the morning, just keeping it balanced. I mean, obviously, I'm trying to stay in shape. I'll be 52 in 2 weeks, but it really balances me out. So I tell every man that I speak to, particularly at work, I had a brother today, his first session. I'm like, bro, you got to work out. You got to work. You got to move that body. There's so much emotional energy stored from years ago. I need you to leave it on the gym floor. I need you to really, you're going to be surprised at the magic that's going to come emotionally as a result of working out. Let the sexiness and the muscles be the bonus, right? But trust me, bruh, trust me on that. I need your butt in that gym. So working out, reading, journaling has really been my thing.
Got it. And speaking of the books, man, what are some of your favorite books? I know you've mentioned you read 4 or 5 books a month, man.
Yeah, I'm reading this thick book called The Myth of Normal by this medical doctor. His name is, I can't think of it. It's a thick book. I just got it. But I usually read 2 at a time and go through about 4 or 5 at a month. And I really read just to stay calm. Like, calm is my superpower. I'm not really trying to rack up some new, you know, like there was a time where I was like, wait till they know that I know this, right? There was an ego thing of how well-versed I am. Now it's just like, let me go in my library and chill out for about 2 hours as a gift to myself. So I read more casually. I mean, when it's time to do research or prepare for a lecture, of course I got to go in. But on the day-to-day, bro, I'm just kicking out back with a good book, man, enjoying the time.
All right, give me some life-changing joints, though, that you read where you were like, whoa. You know?
That's everywhere. You know, there's a time where when I'm reading now, like I read a quote, I shared a video. It says, healing ain't guaranteed, but it is available. Right. And I was like, whoa, like I said, I was like, whoa. So when I get those whoa moments, I usually share that online with social media with the hopes of somebody else saying, whoa. Right. So if it's a whoa with me, I'm like, yeah, I gotta, you know, let me not keep this to myself. So I share my woes, like, and they could be from anywhere. I could be reading or driving down the street or listening to a song. I'd be like, whoa, let me write that down, because my hope is to reach that one brother who has been up all night for days, who's sitting on the edge of that bed, just ready to crash out. And if he can come across me with that one thing, man, and just get him through the night. That's it, because I've been there. And so, you know, that's one of my intentions.
Got it. Favorite thing that a black male has taught you?
Favorite thing that a black male has taught me. That's great. To keep showing up. And that was my father. He was like, 90% of it is showing up. And right now at 52, I'm like, just keep showing up. And I use that, whether it's going to the gym or in private practice or even in a relationship, man. Just show up. Just show up. There's a saying that I got from a guy online that I tell my guys, just get your car to the gym. Don't worry about working out. First thing first, just get your car to the gym. And I live like, just show up to the gym. Let it go from there. Don't overthink it. Get your car to the gym.
That's a good one. All right. Favorite thing that made you, or a moment or event that made you proud to be a black man?
I got so many. I work with a lot of young ones. One of the things, this is one of it, to have a black male, early 20s, young, late teens, come up to me and say, man, I really want to do what you're doing. And the world has ruled him out, right? He got his pants hanging. He got locks everywhere. He got tats on his face. And for him to be like, I like how you move, and I really want to do something like that. That makes me proud, right? To be a black man. The other part is just owning my own experience, Mr. G. Just really at a point in my life where I'm just grateful for it all. I'm not cherry picking on this was hard, this was weak. I'm grateful for it all, and to be able to share a screen with another brother, and look him in the face and was like, "I feel you, and you're gonna be okay." Makes me proud. And as a matter of fact, that's one of my goals. Very first session, I said, my main goal for you is to make you feel proud about who you are in spite of the things you've been through.
Powerful. That's powerful. That's powerful, man. What's your favorite program or event that you've been a part of?
I got so many of them. Let Us Make Man is a local event here that does a lot for the black males in the community. I mean, they do tons. Next Level Boys Academy is an organization here that does a lot. Just making myself available for organizations who specifically serve in black males. And there's quite a few. And those are just the two that I physically go to. I just recently was invited to meet at a barbershop. There was a schedule conflict, so I hadn't done that. One of the things that I'm grateful for, Mr. G, is I often get a lot of invitations like, bro, pull up, can we have? And I'm grateful to be able to, you know, just be where I am in integrity and being a servant where brothers like yourself invite me in. I don't take any of these for granted or light. I'm grateful for the invitation. So anytime a brother asks me to pull up and my schedule allow, you know, I'm there, man.
Appreciate that, man. Favorite person that you would like to sit down and chat with that are alive?
My mother, right? Bless her soul. Mm-hmm. She's passed on. And of course, I chat with her, you know, in spirit, just to kind of get her take on where I am now. That you know, like, what you make of all this? Mom, that would be ideal for me to hear my mom sort of, you know, add words to how she think I'm doing and where I am now.
Got it. What's been your favorite life gem that anybody has given you?
Favorite life gem? That's a good one. Who you are is enough. Like, I've had that majority of my life. Like, who you are is enough.
Gotcha. You know, some black males might be listening to this like, I need to do this, man. We need more Dr. Jaspers out there. I want to become that, you know, and they're going to be trying to become that in, within that 4%. So based on your experiences and your navigation, what advice would you have for those that are like, yo, I want to be, you know, I want to do what Dr. Jaspers do?
When you find someone who is an indirect mentor, whether it's me and there's plenty of brothers out there, not a lot, but plenty of them, study them. Right. We study them. Right. Read their books. Read their posts. Right. Check in with them. Watch their videos. Right. We do it to other people. We do it to these rappers. We do it to these basketball players. Find someone who you really rock with and study them. Right. Ask them questions like you're asking me. I'm on the other end like, bruh, where you get all this stuff from? Mr. G did his homework, bruh. You are not playing. You know I get this all the time. They are not as prepared as you, bruh. Not all
appreciate
of them.
I appreciate it.
But that's the work, right? So brothers watching this could somehow reach out to someone they've been rocking with and say, I saw your videos. I heard your TikTok. I read your book. Right. I tell brothers that before you jump in my DMs, Ryan, check to see if I'm even your dude. Right. Check to see if I'm even your person. I don't got it all together, bro. Trust me. It's still rough over here. But check, you know, rock with me before you jump in and say something. Let me know if I'm your guy. If I'm your guy, let's get it. So find someone who you rock with and exhaust the material they have put forth. I put it out there for that very reason. By the time you call me, I should be your guy, at least unless it just goes downhill from there.
That makes a ton of sense.
Because I share a lot, right? That's my reason for sure. I ain't trying to flex. I'm trying to allow y'all to know who I am with the help of saying, I choose you. And that I'm grateful for.
Powerful, man. Now, you're doing so much work with the community. You're doing so much work for black males, black boys, black men. What is that legacy that you're trying to create and leave behind when it's all said and done, man?
It's good, man. I just want to be known for owning my space and doing it my way, right? I tell brothers all the time, right? I'm choosing me first and I'm causing no harm, right? I tell brothers, choose you first, meaning take care of yourself first and cause no harm. When I mean harm, I mean like direct harm. Obviously, there's some things that come with that, but choose you first. Take care of yourself, your mentality. I want to be known as someone who was available, someone who is authentic and flawful, and someone who, you know, is comfortable in who he is. All right. Long after my days, I want not only my children, but the community to be like, you know, I like some of my written work to be classics, and not from an ego or from my state standpoint, but for some people like, man, that's been 50 years. That still resonate with me. Mm-hmm. I know I've done my job on that level, but I'm still growing, man. I still got a lot to learn. I'm still making errors. The good thing is I'm not taking it nearly as personal, Mr. G, and I'm still doing the healing work.
Thank you for that, man. For those that want some more of Dr. Jasper, either asking questions or maybe for mental health, where can they find you?
All online, man. I am Dr. Curt on Instagram. I have a website, drcurtisdjasper.com. I'm on Facebook as Dr. Curtis D. Jasper and Twitter. If there's a Google, all fails, there's a Google search, there's a number out there that comes right to the business fine. I ain't hard to find, and I'm open to making a difference, right? I'm open to making a difference. So anybody's out there, if this resonates with you, you need to have, you know, just pull up. I ain't hard to find.
There it is, man. Thank you so much, Dr. Jasper, man.
I appreciate you, man.
To you, man. Can you leave us with your favorite quote and what it means to you?
Uncertainty is nothing but pure possibility. Mm. Uncertainty is nothing but pure possibility. So the things that we're uncertain for, you have to choose to remind yourself that on the other side of uncertainty is everything.
Man, definitely left us with some gems today, man. Dr. Jasper, I appreciate you. Likewise, man. Definitely would love to have you back on the program. Thank you so much for spending some time with us, man. I know you're a busy dude, you know.
Appreciate you, man, your diligence and your professionalism.
And hopefully earn, you know, people's attention and respect, because we're trying to build the Black Collective, man. So that's the mission.
I saw it. I checked out a few of yours, man. You're doing it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Appreciate you, man. I didn't know that.
I saw you had Brother Dr. Umar on there, bro.
Sir.
Yeah, that's like, I'm like, okay, my man doing it for sure.
Yeah, we trying to do some, yo, we all need to be doing serious work, man.
You are. I appreciate your platform and your, you know, just your professionalism, man, and just who you are, brother. I'm here for it all, bro.
Listeners, make sure you follow Dr. Jasper. Check out his TED Talk, because that talk, man, it'll have you in your feelings, man. But it is definitely awareness that we need to have of some of the things that Black males, Black men are going through. And like we talked about today, to be that support system, and to understand how to support Black men and Black males and Black boys, because we don't get enough of that. And, you know, listen to our stories, man. And you know, let's be better with how we deal with Black men. And of course, remember, your mind is the most powerful tool in the universe. Therefore, if you can think it, you can do it. If you believe in it, you can be it. And if you fight for it, you can have it. The world is yours. This has been your host, Mr. G. And I will see you next time on Mastermind.
Appreciate you, my guy. So every day I'm going hard. I'm talking business, bank accounts, and credit cards. And somehow we defeat the odds and making sure that no one starves. Illegal, or you had a job.